Okay, so the starting point of this talk is the observation that string theory predicts that space-time has extra dimensions. And of course, exact solutions of higher dimensional supergravity theories are important in string theory. So we have things like black brains, black holes, PP waves, and various intersections and superpositions of these objects. And these are all very important in string theory. Now, until recently, it was widely believed that these kind of objects, especially black brains and black holes, would exhibit rather similar properties to their counterparts in four dimensions, so four-dimensional black holes. But a couple of recent discoveries have shown that's untrue. So the first is the work of Gary and Kengo on non-uniform brains. So what they showed is that, what they suggested, is that as well as, for example, in five-dimensional vacuum gravity, as well as black strings, which have a metric consisting of the Schwarzschild metric times a flat direction, in addition to these solutions of five-dimensional vacuum gravity, we also have black strings with event horizons that aren't uniform in the fifth direction. So although Gary and Kengo suggested that these solutions should exist, they couldn't find an explicit form for the metric analytically, and the best that's been done so far is a nice paper, recent paper by Wiseman, who found these solutions numerically. So this is our first indication that in higher dimensions, exact solutions of general relativity can behave rather differently from in four dimensions. And the second indication comes from thinking about black holes in higher dimensions. Again, let's think about five-dimensional vacuum gravity. And there, we now know that as well as spherical rotating black hole solutions, so these are Myers-Perry black hole solutions, we have other solutions which were found by Emperin and myself, which look like this, ring-shaped. So so if I draw a little table to compare four and five-dimensional black holes, so here's four dimensions, here's five dimensions, then I can fill in the topology. So in four dimensions, all black holes are spherical. That was proved by Hawking back in the 70s. But in five dimensions, we have black holes with spherical event horizons, we have black holes with these new solutions, black ring solutions, which have event horizons, which have topology S2 cross S1, and we really don't know what else is possible. Second property concerns black hole uniqueness. So in four dimensions, the black hole uniqueness theorem tells us that a black hole is uniquely specified by its mass and its angular momentum and its charges. So in four dimensions, black holes are unique, but the existence of these solutions, as I explained on Tuesday, tells us that in five dimensions, black holes aren't unique. And presumably, if we go to higher dimensions, we'd expect things to be just as complicated. So what I want to emphasize is that we have some exact solutions describing higher dimensional black holes. We have these Myers-Perry black hole rotating solutions and these new black ring solutions. But we don't really have any reason to believe that those are the only black hole solutions present in higher dimensions. So it's interesting to ask what we know for certain about general properties of higher dimensional black holes. And again, this is something that I touched on in my colloquium on Tuesday, so I'll just say a little bit about it here. So the question is, what do we know in general about black holes in higher dimensions? And it seems to me that we can extract one useful piece of information. And that comes from a theorem in four dimensions due to Hawking. So what Hawking showed is that a stationary a non-static four-dimensional black hole will emit a Killing vector field psi, which is null on the event horizon, and commutes with the stationary Killing vector field. So I'll just remind you what that stationary means. So stationary means that the solution has a time translation symmetry. So there's a Killing vector field which is time-like near infinity. So a stationary but non-static black hole is basically a rotating black hole with a time symmetry. So what Hawking's theorem tells us is that there's another symmetry. In addition to the time translation symmetry, we expect a second symmetry associated with this Killing vector field psi, which is null on the event horizon. And the reason that this second symmetry is disjoint from the time translation symmetry is that the time translation Killing vector field, which I can call K, is typically space-like on the event horizon. So that's familiar from properties of the Kerr black hole. There's an ergo region where K becomes space-like. Whereas psi is null on the event horizon, so therefore psi and K must be different. So the solution, a general stationary black hole, has two commuting Killing vector fields. So this is Hawking's theorem in four dimensions. Now, this theorem probably does generalize to higher dimensions. If you look at how it's proved, there doesn't seem to be anything in it that's intrinsically four-dimensional. So, write that down. So in other words, in any dimension higher than four, a general stationary black hole would have two commuting Killing vector fields. But all known solutions have much more symmetry . They have the integer part of d plus 1 over 2 commuting Killing vector fields. So the known solutions are the Myers-Perry rotating black hole solutions and the black ring solutions that Emperin and I found. So all known high-dimensional black hole solutions have more symmetry than this general theorem predicts. So either we have to somehow justify the existence of all these extra symmetries, or we have to accept that the black holes that we know about are just rather special black holes, and in general we'd expect a typical high-dimensional black hole to have much less symmetry. And that's what I'm suggesting. So what I suggested in this paper is so basically the conjecture is that really there should be black hole solutions which have only the amount of symmetry that Hawking's theorem gives us. So in other words, there exist stationary higher dimensional black hole solutions of the vacuum Einstein equations that have exactly two commuting Killing vector fields. And of course we don't know any such solutions. And the reason we don't know any such solutions is they don't have very much symmetry. Not necessarily stable. No, I'm not saying anything about stability. No one has ever studied the stability of high-dimensional black holes, so it's very hard to say anything about stability. Okay, so why would we believe this conjecture? Well, one reason for thinking it might be true is what I've told you about black strings. So in the case of black strings, we had a set of uniform solutions which have a lot of symmetry, which we understand analytically. But recently it's been discovered that in addition to those, there's another class of solutions which we don't have analytically, only numerically, and those have less symmetry. So the suggestion here is that black holes should exhibit similar behaviour. Now, for the case of the black string, one way of seeing the existence of these solutions is to look at perturbations of the uniform solution. And one finds that the uniform black string solutions actually emits a perturbation, a metric perturbation, that makes it look like this. So there's a static metric perturbation that makes the uniform black string look non-uniform. So perhaps a way of testing this conjecture will be to look at perturbations of the black holes that we know and understand, which have a lot of symmetry, to see if there are any stationary perturbations that break some of that symmetry. So in other words, we could test that conjecture by finding a stationary zero mode of Myers-Perry solutions that break some of the symmetry, some of the accidental symmetry, which we don't expect from Hawking's theorem. So these solutions have too much symmetry, and the idea is that there should be some, one way of testing this conjecture is to look for a zero mode which breaks some of the accidental symmetry, some of the additional symmetries that we didn't expect to find from Hawking's theorem. Okay, so that's one way, a calculation that needs to be done. No one has ever studied perturbations of high-dimensional black holes, as I said to Jim. So this is certainly something I think will be worth looking at. Another reason, of course, for studying perturbations of high-dimensional black holes will be, of course, to address the issue of stability. Okay, so that's all I really wanted to say about general properties of black holes in higher dimensions. And really the purpose of this first part of the talk was just to emphasize how little we really know about general properties of black holes and black brains in higher dimensions, and to emphasize how little we understand about exact solutions of the Einstein equations in higher dimensions. So just to reiterate, in the case of the black strings, here we expect some new solutions, we don't know them analytically. In the case of this conjecture, that conjecture predicts there should be new solutions, but of course we don't even know those numerically. So it suggests there are lots of interesting discoveries that remain to be made in higher dimensional gravity, but of course solving the Einstein equations is very hard. So actually finding these solutions or those solutions is rather tough. And in order to get a better understanding of exact solutions, we need to somehow simplify the problem and work in a more controlled setting. And the controlled setting I'd like to work in is within the framework of supersymmetry. So from now on, I'm just going to be thinking about supersymmetric solutions of supergravity theories. So I'm interested in general properties of supersymmetric solutions of supergravity theories. Now, why are supersymmetric solutions important? Well, I probably don't have to emphasize that here, but I'm going to do so anyway. Well, there are various reasons. Well, sometimes we can argue that when we have for certain supersymmetric solutions, we have an exact solution of string theory, sometimes. So we have an exact conformal field theory description of some supersymmetric solutions. Often we expect them to be stable. And then sometimes we expect them to have certain non-renormalization properties. So an example of where these kind of properties are important is in the black hole entropy calculations. So let's take that as an example. So in the black hole entropy calculations, we imagine having some microscopic description of brains wrapped around some compact extra dimensions, which we understand weak string coupling. And then as we increase the string coupling, the idea is that this turns into a black hole which lives in the uncompactified dimensions. So we have a black hole at strong coupling. Now, an important assumption that underlies this picture. So the idea here is that the way we tell which black hole solution corresponds to which microscopic string configuration is that we demand they have the same charges. In other words, but that only makes sense if there's only one black hole with the given charges. Okay, but I've just told you that generally in high dimensions, we don't expect there to be a uniqueness theorem for black holes. So, in other words, the black hole entropy calculations, this picture of matching up a weakly coupled brain configuration with a strongly coupled black hole description, relies on assuming uniqueness of supersymmetric black holes. So, of course, the assumption of supersymmetry is important if we're to trust our weakly coupled calculations in string theory in the extrapolation to strong coupling. Now, you may say, well, we know for four-dimensional black holes, we expect them to be unique. We have a uniqueness theorem for such black holes, so surely this must be true. So why bother worrying about this? Well, the reason to worry about this is that rotating supersymmetric black holes only exist in five dimensions. So the first example of such solutions were found by Breckenridge, Myers, Pete and Vaffer. So if we're interested in the most general possible black holes for which we can, which we have a microscopic description in string theory, then we're interested in rotating black holes. And then this observation forces us to five dimensions. So in other words, to higher dimensional black holes. But I started this talk by telling you that in general, five-dimensional black holes are not unique. We have more than one different species of black hole with a given set of asymptotic charges. So let me remind you is that we had black holes of spherical topology, and then we have these black ring solutions, both rotating, and they can carry the same asymptotic charges. And if this happened for supersymmetric solutions, then this assumption of the black hole entropy calculations would be problematic. So this is one motivation for being interested in general properties of higher dimensional supersymmetric solutions. So in particular, a question you might ask is whether this can happen. So these guys here give us some rotating spherical supersymmetric black holes. You might also ask if there are rotating supersymmetric black rings. So do supersymmetric black rings exist, for example? And if they did, then this assumption underlying the black hole entropy calculations would be wrong. Could be wrong. Okay, so how do we go about answering this kind of question? We want to know whether exotic supersymmetric black holes can exist in higher dimensions, just as there exist exotic non-supersymmetric black holes. And more generally, we're interested in understanding the general nature of supersymmetric solutions of higher dimensional supergravity theories, because recently we've seen that for non-supersymmetric solutions, they can be much richer, exhibit a much richer structure than we previously suspected. So what about supersymmetric solutions? So the goal of what the work I want to describe in this talk is to answer that question by finding all of the supersymmetric solutions of a higher dimensional supergravity theory. So this is the goal. We're going to find all supersymmetric solutions of the simplest higher dimensional supergravity theory, which is the minimal five dimensional supergravity. So what that looks like is the following. So the bosonic sector of this theory has the following action. So it's basically Einstein-Maxwell theory with a Chern-Simons coupling. Throughout this talk, I'm not going to bother with numerical factors. So. So schematically, that's what the action looks like. So that's what I'm going to describe in this talk. How one goes about finding all of the supersymmetric solutions of that theory. Of course, we know some particular supersymmetric solutions of that theory, but here the motivation is to achieve a general understanding of supersymmetric solutions in supergravity theory by finding all of the supersymmetric solutions of this theory. Now, you may say, well, that sounds pretty tough. How could we possibly find all of the supersymmetric solutions? Surely what the best we can do is just start from some ansatz, plug it into the supersymmetry variation, and demand that it vanishes. But in fact, one can actually do better than that, and it's been done before. So this problem has been addressed before, but in four dimensions. So in fact, almost 20 years ago, Paul Todd found all the supersymmetric solutions of the minimal n equals 2 d equals 4 theory. And the minimal n equals 2 d equals 4 theory is Einstein-Maxwell theory in four dimensions with fermions. So back in 1983, Paul Todd studied this four-dimensional supergravity theory, and he constructed all of the supersymmetric solutions of this theory. And for that theory, what he found was that the solutions fall into two classes. So the first class is just PP waves, and the second class are what are known as the Israel-Wilson-Payers solutions, which look like this. So here V is a complex harmonic function, and V to the minus 1 is harmonic on this flat three-dimensional space here. And this rotation, one form omega, which also lives on this flat three-dimensional transverse space, is specified by solving some equation like this. So these are the solutions. So special cases of this class of solutions, for example, include the Majumder-Papapetru solutions, including multi-Riesz and Nordstrom solutions, and various other solutions.
Maybe like Taubnut, or is it not?
I guess Taubnut's...
It's Euclidean, of course, but it looks...
Yeah, there is actually a charged version of Lorentzian Taubnut, which lives in this class of solutions. So these solutions were actually investigated by Jim and Stephen Hawking in a paper about 30 years ago. And they conjectured, in fact, that the only black hole solutions that belong to this class are the multi-Riesz and Nordstrom solutions. And in fact, that conjecture is still unproved. So, but no one expects it to be untrue.
We have a particular definition of black hole, which is supposed to be asymptotically planned, and the strats.
Yeah. Okay, so. So that's what's been done in four dimensions. But as I said, we want to do that in higher dimensions, for the simplest higher dimensional supergravity theory. So how do we go about doing that? So the strategy is the following. So if we're given a supercovariantly constant spinner, so epsilon, I'm going to assume, is a four-component Dirac spinner, so it satisfies some equation of this form. So here, F is the Maxwell field. Again, I'm forgetting numerical factors here. Then starting from epsilon, what we do is we build bosonic quantities we ask what bosonic quantities can we construct given a solution admitting a supercovariantly constant spinner. So we can construct a real scalar, which I call F, which is basically epsilon squared. I can construct a real vector V, by sandwiching a gamma matrix with epsilon, and then I can construct three real two forms, which I'll call Xi. So two of these real two forms are given by this equation. Can you see over there, Jim? Good. And the third of those two forms is given by just sandwiching epsilon bar epsilon. So C here is the charge conjugation matrix. So what I want to emphasize is that since we know our solution is supersymmetric, that's our assumption, we're starting from a supersymmetric solution, then epsilon is going to be globally well behaved. And it follows from that these quantities will be globally well behaved. Okay. So that's what bosonic quantities I can define. So what can I do with them now? Well, the first is I can ask how they're related. And they're related by using the Fiat's identity, satisfied by the spinner. And that gives me various algebraic identities. So the first algebraic identity is, in fact, a projection on the spinner, involving my vector V and my scalar F. And then other algebraic identities hold between those bosonic objects. So for example, I have a restriction on the norm of V. So V squared is minus F squared. So that vector V is time-like or null everywhere. Other algebraic conditions I have look like this. So for these two forms, if I contract the vector with a two form, that has to vanish. So here, this I subscript V just means contract V with the first index of this two form. And then finally, the only other condition I'll need concerns the contraction of V with the dual of these two forms. And that looks like some kind of generalized self-duality condition. So these are the algebraic some of the algebraic conditions that hold between those bosonic quantities. Actually, there's a third one I should write down, which concerns those two forms. So I have a formula telling me what happens if I contract one of these two forms with another two form. Okay, so those are purely algebraic, but I also know that epsilon satisfies this differential equation, and I can use that to derive differential conditions on these bosonic objects. So the fact that epsilon is supercoherently constant tells me the following. First, it tells me what the exterior derivative of F is. Is simply V contracted with the Maxwell field. Okay, so that just follows from differentiating this equation using this. And if I take another exterior derivative of that, it tells me that the Lie derivative of the Maxwell field with respect to V has to vanish. A second condition coming from this equation comes if I differentiate V. So it turns out the symmetric part of the covariant derivative of V vanishes. So V is a Killing vector field. And then I can ask about the anti-symmetric part of this, and that gives me an equation that looks like this. So the exterior derivative acting on V, if I view V as a one form, is given, it depends on the Maxwell field as well as the scalar F and the vector V. And then finally I can differentiate these two forms. I'm not going to write out what that gives because it's a bit complicated, but one can work out what it is. So it gives you something on the right hand side. I just have an expression which depends on the Maxwell field and the two forms. A special case of this though does tell me that these two forms are closed. Okay, so we have a whole bunch of relationships between these bosonic quantities. And now what we want to do is basically solve these and determine what the metric is and what this the Maxwell field is. So we can do that just by analysing these equations. And one finds the following. So there are basically two cases to consider depending on whether this scalar F is vanishing or non-vanishing. So let me first deal with... In fact, I might only have time to deal with one case, which is the most interesting case. We call the time-like case, in which the scalar function F doesn't vanish everywhere. So there's some region where it's non-vanishing. So in other words, what I can do is I can pick a region, which I'll call U, in which F is positive, say. F might be negative, but without loss of generality, I can assume F is positive, effectively. So I'll do that. It turns out the case of negative F is related by a simple transformation. So I'm going to work in some region U where F is positive. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to determine the full solution in U, and then I'm going to extend it outside U by analytic continuation. So in U, I know that V squared is minus F squared, so V is a time-like Killing vector field. And I can choose coordinates, choose a time coordinate t, such that v is d by dt. So I'll do that. Having done that, I can then write down a local form for the metric as follows. Ds squared is minus f squared into dt plus some one form omega plus f to the minus 1 hmn dxm dxn. So the reason I know that there's an f squared here is that I know that v squared is minus f squared, so d by dt squared is minus f squared, so I have to have an f squared here. But you can see the rest of the metric is essentially arbitrary. So this h is in principle an arbitrary metric. I've just rescaled by a factor of f to the minus 1 here for convenience. And this omega is a one form, which only has components in these transverse directions, which I've called x. So these other coordinates x are, at present, completely undetermined. So omega... So let me... This metric here is defined by projecting the five-dimensional metric orthogonally to this Killing vector field V. So if I write V as a one form, it's basically this. And if I project the full metric orthogonally to that V, I get this.
So this Killing field must be time-like everywhere. So there's no lower region.
Everywhere in U. Yeah, that's a simple fact from that, yeah.
If you get from the super.
Yeah, I'm going to comment on that a bit later.
In four dimensions, these Israel-Wilson Kreis metrics, those are like Kerr-Newman, with Q equals M, and momentum non-zero.
Yeah, yeah.
So they would have a Killing field which...
That's still time-like everywhere.
So it's still time-like everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's the same in that case. In that case, V is also, it has to be time-like or null. And that's true everywhere. Okay, so this metric H, I'm going to call, defines for me a metric on a four-dimensional Riemannian space, which I'm going to refer to as the base space, B. So HMN is a metric on a four-dimensional Riemannian space, and I'm going to call that Riemannian space B. And I get that essentially by projecting the metric orthogonal to the Killing vector field V, and then rescaling by some power of F. Now, one comment I should make here is that writing V equals D by DT doesn't determine T uniquely, because I have to choose my origin for the time coordinate. And that ambiguity is reflected in the fact that omega is only defined locally. And in fact, I can always, it's only determined up to a gradient. So omega isn't uniquely defined by this decomposition. Okay, so what do we do next? So the next step is to decompose the FD omega, the field strength of omega, if you like, the exterior derivative of omega, into self-dual and anti-self-dual parts with respect to that four-dimensional Riemannian metric on the base space. So FD omega I'll write as G plus plus G minus, where G plus minus is self-dual or anti-self-dual on the base space. So this is the Hodge dual on B. Okay, so I've just decomposed into self-dual and anti-self-dual parts. And now what I can do is I can examine my equations for dF and dV, which fortunately are still here, so this equation and this equation. I can plug in that form for the metric, and then it turns out I can actually solve for the Maxwell field. And what it looks like is this. So that's the solution for the Maxwell field, just following from those equations for dF and dV. And I can also write that another way. I can write that as the exterior derivative of something. So I can write it as an exact part plus G plus. So I can write it that way. Okay. Now, of course, I can impose the Bianchi identity for F. Well, obviously, this is already closed, so the only restriction from the Bianchi identity is that this quantity G plus has to be closed. And next, I can use the Maxwell equation, the equation of motion for F, what that gives me is the following equation. It gives me an equation for my scalar function F that looks like a Poisson-like equation. So here delta is the Laplacian on B. Okay. So I've solved for the Maxwell field here, and I've imposed the Maxwell field's equations of motion. Now I can think about my two forms. Remember, I have three two forms, xi, and I can think about what I know about them. Well, the first thing I know about them is that when I contract them with V, they vanish. And that tells me that these two forms, Xi, live on the base space. Secondly, I had a kind of generalized anti-self-duality condition on the Xi's, which on the base space reduces to this. So these two forms are anti-self-dual. Finally, I had an algebraic relationship between the Xi's, which followed from the Fiat's identity. And if I now write that out, it gives me the following. Xj So here I've raised indices with my metric on the base space with H. So this equation, of course, is the equation defining a hypercalar structure. So these two forms, Xi, define for me an almost hypercalar structure. And the chalk's going low resolution. Oops. Finally, though, so this is that's the algebraic condition, which tells me I have an almost hypercalar structure. But finally, I had a differential condition for the Xi's, and it turns out that in these coordinates, it just reduces to the condition that the Xi's are covariantly constant. So in other words, the hypercalar structure is integrable. So finally, I've deduced that the base space B is hypercalar. And that's it. If I now look at the Killing Spinner equation, and I plug my metric, and I plug this solution for the field strength into the Killing Spinner equation, I find that it does admit a Killing Spinner. And in fact, this condition, and this condition now guarantee the solution is supersymmetric. And I haven't made any assumptions in deriving this form for the solution. So let's see, I'll probably erase down to here. So the guarantees. And the, if you want to know what the killing spinner looks like, it's this. So I pick a killing spinner eta on the hypercalor space. And it has to obey a certain chirality condition. But that's it. Okay, so that's the solution in the time-like case, the case where F doesn't vanish everywhere.
So this is the statement that the converse is true or something. I mean, you start off assuming you had supersymmetry.
Yes.
To derive these conditions.
Yes.
And now you're claiming that they're sufficient.
That they're sufficient as well as necessary.
Okay,
yeah.
So
okay. So the, yeah. So using, assuming those conditions, I then find that there is a killing spinner, and therefore it is sufficient. Okay, so that's the general solution. What do we know? Well, let me give you some examples of solutions that fit into this, this general solution. So we have the supersymmetric rotating black hole. Okay, so this was found by Breckenridge, Myers, Pete and Vaffer. And it was shown that this can be embedded in this particular theory, this minimal supergravity theory, by Gauntlet, Myers and Townsend. So that solution is obtained by choosing my hypercalor space, my base space, just to be flat Euclidean space, R4. So I can write the metric as this. I can introduce Euler angles. I write in spherical polar coordinates, so I introduce Euler angles on the 3-sphere. And then I get a metric that looks like this. Cos theta. Okay, so these are Euler angles on the 3-sphere. And then the solution for the function f is that f to the minus 1 is 1 plus some constant mu over r squared, and the solution for my one form omega is j over r squared times this one form here. Now if you look at this, you'll see that this f to the minus 1 is harmonic here, and it turns out that's, well, obviously that's only condition with, it's only consistent with this condition if g plus vanishes, and it, but of course if I plug this solution into my expression for G plus, I do find that G plus vanishes, so everything's consistent. So this solution has a number of interesting properties. So notice that it depends on two constants, J and mu. So if J squared is less than mu cubed, which basically means that the solution has a sufficiently small angular momentum, then d by d psi, which is a killing vector field, is space-like outside an event horizon, which is r equals zero, and we have a supersymmetric rotating black hole. However, if this condition is violated, then the solution no longer describes a black hole. So if j squared is greater than mu cubed, then d by d psi is time-like near r equals zero. So, and there's no event horizon, so these, so I have naked closed time-like curves. So if d psi, remember, is an Euler angle, and therefore it's identified with period 4 pi, so if d by d psi is time-like, then the orbits of d by d psi are closed time-like curves. So I have naked closed time-like curves in this case.
You also have naked singularities, though.
No.
No?
No. Let me tell you about that. Okay, so this was analysed by Gibbons and Herdero, and they showed that this space-time is actually geodesically complete. There's no singularity in this space-time. Their close time-like curves are localized to a region near r equals zero, and the space-time is completely regular everywhere. So in other words, it's an asymptotically flat time machine. If you go down near the origin, you can do time travel. So that's a little worrying. It's a supersymmetric solution, so we think maybe we should understand it a bit better than a general solution with closed time-like curves. But nevertheless, it has these naked closed time-like curves. However, this rotating black hole here, I can get in string theory by a rotating version of the D1-D5 system, if I lift it up to the 2B theory. And that we think we understand. If I now think about what this looks like in terms of the D1-D5 system, it turns out that if I take the D1-D5 system and try and violate this bound, as I've done here, then the world volume theory becomes non-unitary. So it looks like the microscopic description also goes bad in this, if this inequality is satisfied.
What does that mean? Does more of the charge become negative or something?
I think you can see it by, how does it work? I don't remember how it's worked, but this how it works, but this was worked out in a paper by Herdero. I don't remember the details now at the moment. So he was one of Gibbon's students. Okay. Now I'd like to introduce a piece of terminology at this point. So we have closed time-like curves here, and it turns out that it's easy to produce space times with closed time-like curves. I can just take Minkowski space and identify the time direction. But obviously, I can remove those by going to a covering space. So in some sense, they're trivial. So there's a definition due to Brandon Carter, which says that space-time with closed time-like curves has trivial closed time-like curves if I can remove them by going to a covering space. Okay, so trivial CTCs are not present or absent in covering space. So that's just a definition. And it turns out for this space-time, the CTCs are non-trivial in 5 dimensions, but if I lift up to 10 dimensions, then they become trivial. Okay, so one of the initial motivations for doing this work was asking about uniqueness of supersymmetric black holes, because I told you that's an assumption underlying the black hole entropy calculations. However, so here we have all the supersymmetric solutions, effectively. However, we have them in a form, I've just rubbed the metric off, unfortunately. This form, and you can see that since I've assumed that f is positive here, this form, these coordinates are only valid locally, and in particular they're not valid at the event horizon of any black holes that might be present in this space-time. So it's far from obvious how I go from this solution to extracting all the black hole solutions. And that was the subject of a recent paper that I listed at the beginning. In view of the time, maybe I won't go through that, but let me just say it in words. If I assume that I have a black hole solution, then I know the event horizon is a null hypersurface, and in the neighborhood of a null hypersurface, I can introduce a particular preferred set of coordinates, which are Gaussian null coordinates. And then the idea is just to repeat the analysis that I've explained here, but in that coordinate system. And if you do that, then you find that the near horizon geometry for a supersymmetric solution with a compact Killing horizon is one of the following. It's either flat space, which is trivial. It's ADS3 cross S2, or it's the near horizon geometry of that rotating supersymmetric black hole. those are the only three possibilities. So you see that by repeating this analysis, but in that Gaussian null coordinate system. And then if I then match these solutions onto this solution and demand that it be asymptotically flat, then I get a uniqueness theorem for supersymmetric rotating black holes. Okay, so one can prove that the only supersymmetric black hole in minimal five-dimensional supergravity is this rotating BMPV black hole. So that's the first example of a uniqueness theorem for supersymmetric black holes. But I don't want to tell you about that. I want to tell you about something more interesting. Going back to time machines, because time machines are fun. And that's a supersymmetric version of the Gödel universe. So take my general solution, take my hyperkähler space to be R4, with the standard Cartesian metric, I'm going to set my scalar function just to be identically 1, which is pretty simple, and then I'll choose my one form omega to be J, which is the Kähler form on R4, which I can write as this, in this way. So this is Kähler form on R4. So since this is anti-self-dual, that means that d omega is anti-self-dual. So this two-form G plus I introduced has to vanish here, which is then consistent with the equation of motion for F. So a particular choice is to choose omega to be the following. Okay, so that's a good choice for omega, and then the solution takes this form. So it's a very simple looking solution. I just take flat space, I add a time direction, and I shove in this one form to describe a rotation. And the Maxwell field is proportional to the Kähler form, J. Now, so that's a set of coordinates, but to understand the solution a bit better, it's interesting to go to a different set of coordinates on R4. So I just use polar coordinates on R4, in which I take x1 and x2 to polar coordinates r1 and phi1. So in the x1, 2 plane, I just introduce polar coordinates r1, phi1. And I, in the x3, x4 plane, I go to polar coordinates r2, phi2. And in these coordinates, what the solution looks like is the following. Okay, so that's what the solution looks like in these polar coordinates. F is r1 dr1 wedge dφ1 minus r2 dr2 wedge dφ2. You can read that. Okay, right, what do we know about this solution? Firstly, although it looks like there might be some kind of singularities there at r1 vanishing or r2 vanishing, if I go back to my original Cartesian coordinates, it turns out everything's perfectly regular. So this is regular everywhere, this solution. Second point, what is it? Well, you can see that basically I've taken flat space, added a time direction, made it rotate, and there's a magnetic field present. So it describes a rotating universe with a magnetic field. Secondly, if you work out the isometry group of this solution, it turns out to be rather large. It turns out the isometry group is 9-dimensional. So some of the isometries are obvious. Obviously d by dt, d by dφ1, d by dφ2 are all isometries. But then it turns out that I have an extra 6 symmetries which aren't so apparent in those coordinates. shouldn't bother writing them down, but the isometry group is nine-dimensional. And this is the same dimension as the isometry group of ADS2 cross S3 or ADS3 cross S2, which of course are very well known, very symmetric solutions. Next property is that that isometry group acts transitively on the spacetime. In other words, I can take any point in that spacetime to any other point by acting with an isometry. And what that means is the solution is homogeneous. And then finally, the solution is trivial topology. It's just the topology is just R4 with the time direction. So the topology is R5. Completely trivial. Now, let's consider the norm of d by d phi 1. So that's R1 squared minus R1 to the fourth. We can see that d by d phi 1 becomes time-like for R1 greater than 1. But phi is a polar angle, and therefore is periodically identified, so I must have closed time-like curves. But notice that I have trivial topology. So in Carter's nomenclature, I have non-trivial closed time-like curves in this space-time. And moreover, because the solution is homogeneous, all points are equivalent, and therefore I have closed time-like curves through every point of the space-time. And this is interesting because this turns out to be exactly the same property as we have in a very familiar, or very famous solution of four-dimensional general relativity, which was found by Gödel in the 40s. And the reason his solution was so interesting is because it provoked interest in time machines in general relativity. It's the first non-trivial example of a time machine in general relativity. Here we've seen that, in fact, if we lift his solution to five dimensions, well, in five dimensions, there is a solution which is supersymmetric and has the same properties as his solution. Okay. Let me just describe a few more properties of this solution, perhaps the most interesting properties. First, if we calculate the killing spinners, it turns out this solution is maximally supersymmetric in five dimensions. So it preserves all eight supercharges. Now let me lift it to 11 dimensions. If I do that, I get the following solution. So lifting to 11 dimensions just gives me an extra 6 dimensions, which are toroidal, but I can replace them by R6 if I want. And the fourth form is given by J wedge K, where J is the Kähler form on R4, and K is the Kähler form on R6. Now, let me calculate how many supersymmetries this preserves. And now comes the surprise. We get 20 supersymmetries. Now, naively, if I take a solution in five dimensions with eight supercharges and lift it to 11 dimensions, I should still have eight supercharges. But here I get 20. So...
I'm sorry, I'm a little confused. W has to stay a one form.
W, omega, yeah.
Omega has to stay a one form.
Omega is still determined just by J, the Kähler form on R4. It still just lives in these directions.
Oh, it still is just...
Yeah, so the metric doesn't depend on these directions. Only the four form does. Now, this is the first example of a solution that preserves an exotic fraction of supersymmetry, a fraction between half and one, that isn't a plane wave. All other solutions that preserve peculiar fractions of supersymmetry are plane waves. However, it turns out there's a relationship between this solution and plane waves, and I can get that by T-duality. So if I reduce this solution to 2A, a 2A solution, then that gives me a solution with non-vanishing Nevo-Schwartz 3 form, and Ramond-Ramond 4 form. Now let me T-dualize. Well, because the 3 form, Nevo-Schwartz 3 form is non-trivial, when I T-dualize, I'll change the metric. And in fact, what I get is a 2B plane wave. And this was pointed out in a recent paper by Herdero, and independently in a second paper by Hashava and three of his students.
The 2B plane wave was what other thing is
turned I guess you can see that by thinking a bit more about the T-duality, but I can't remember offhand. I guess it's just, I don't know. But all the details are in their paper. But we know in the plane wave, we don't generally expect plane waves to have closed time-like curves. So you might think, well, maybe the T-duality somehow gets rid of these closed time-like curves. Well, it turns out that's not quite the case. In the T-dual space-time, the closed time-like curves are still there, but they're now trivial. In other words, I can remove them by going to a covering space. And the Hoshava collaboration also looked for more general girdle solutions by repeating the logic and starting with the maximally supersymmetric 2B plane wave and showing what that gave. And they found that that gave you essentially a nine-dimensional version of the girdle universe as opposed to the five-dimensional one I've been talking about. All right, I'm out of time, so I'll just say what else these guys did. So another thing they looked at was thinking about holography in the girdle background. So they looked in the sense of Busso, they looked for screens, holographic screens in the girdle background, and they showed that if you restrict to the interior of a holographic screen, then there are no closed time-like curves. Don't know what that means. They didn't know what it means, but it's suggestive. So the physics in the interior of the screen has no closed time-like curves. Okay, I've run over a little. I shan't bother writing this. Let me just tell you what my conclusions are then. So I started by telling you that in four-dimensional in high dimensions, general relativity, we really don't understand general properties of black holes and black brains. And I presented a conjecture which suggests that there should be many new black hole solutions, rotating black hole solutions, just of purely vacuum gravity when one goes to higher dimensions. As I've been explaining, one can find all of the supersymmetric solutions of the simplest higher-dimensional supergravity. And this is the first time anyone has constructed all of the supersymmetric solutions of a higher-dimensional supergravity. Then, as I briefly mentioned, one can use that to prove uniqueness of supersymmetric black holes in five dimensions, and thereby fill in a gap which is present in the black hole entropy calculations. And then, perhaps most interestingly, I've been telling you about a supersymmetric five-dimensional generalization of the girdle universe, which when you lift to 11 dimensions preserves a lot of supersymmetry and is T-dual to a plane wave. Something I didn't have time to tell you about was the special case in which my function f vanished everywhere. So when I derived the general form for the solution, I assumed that f wasn't identically zero. But one can also examine the case in which f is identically zero, and again one can find the solution. And it turns out this solution describes what's known as a plane-fronted wave. Sorry, I didn't have time to describe that, but if anyone's interested, I can tell them about that. So this is something that's a bit more general than a PP wave. So a PP wave is what you get if you stand a long way from a torch. A plane-fronted wave is what you get if someone waves the torch around. So the direction of propagation isn't covariantly constant. Okay, those are conclusions. Open questions. So I conjectured that there should be these new black hole solutions in higher dimensions, so it would be interesting to find evidence for those, perhaps by looking for zero modes of the known solutions. Coming to the supersymmetric stuff, so I've explained how you find all of the supersymmetric solutions of the simplest higher dimensional supergravity theory, so it would be interesting to know for what other theories we can do that. We really don't have a very good understanding of why we could find all of the supersymmetric solutions of this theory. So it would be nice if there was some a priori way of knowing, if you give me a supergravity theory, where if we can apply this procedure to construct all of the supersymmetric solutions. We really don't understand why it works for some theories and not for others. So even in four dimensions, Paul Todd thought about the n equals 4 theory, and he wasn't able to find all the supersymmetric solutions for that case. So it's not clear why this works. Secondly, well, maybe I won't mention that. So finally, as I've been describing this solution has lots of supersymmetry and it's related to a plane wave. And over the last year, we've come to realise that although plane waves have Riemann-Riemann fluxes turned on, we can still do string theory in them if they have a lot of supersymmetry. So maybe it would be interesting to attempt string theory directly in the girdle background. And maybe that will help us understand what quantum gravity has to say about closed time-like curves. Well, I'm not that optimistic about that, but thank you.
So I guess I have a bunch of questions and comments, but I'll limit myself to two. So first of all, I think there has been some discussion of strings in this supersymmetric griddle solution. I can give you some references. I mean, this is a constant magnetic field background. And in that context, well, Justin David, who was a postdoc here last year, wrote a paper describing some aspects of strings in this background.
In this particular background?
I think so. I think I have a paper on this also with Arkady Zeitlin.
Well, Arkady, I think that was a slightly different solution. So Arkady did actually find the five-dimensional girdle solution in one of his papers, but it's in a footnote. So he certainly didn't appreciate what it described. And I think the solutions that you and he found were probably slightly different. I'm not certain, but
Okay. But my question was, what do you know if other solutions in the supersymmetric case which don't have closed timeline curves?
You mean in general?
Yeah.
Well, obviously there's the rotating black hole.
Right.
Well, that does have closed timeline curves, but they're beyond the event horizon. we didn't find that many interesting new solutions. That is generically the problem, is that when you try to construct new solutions, typically you either run into a curvature singularity or you run into closed timeline curves. So we found lots of other solutions that are regular, but they still have closed timeline curves. So as you saw, the general form for the metric involves a general hypercalor manifold. So if you want to look for solutions, and there's quite a lot of scope for plugging different hypercalor manifolds in there and seeing what that gives. So the class of solutions is pretty large. So by no means have we done an exhaustive investigation of the properties of solutions. We've just found a local form for all solutions.
But since you know it's hypercalor and four-dimensional, does that mean it's like locally K3?
No. That's the only compact hypercalor surface. Yeah. So in general, we're interested in non-compact spacetimes, of course. So.
More questions?
Okay. So when you generalized to the 2D plane wave, you said you just go to covering space and get rid of it.
Yeah.
Have you then taken that
T-dualized
back?
Well, when you take that to T-dualized back, you first have to put it on a circle, which...
So you just lose any...
Well, if you want to T-dualize it back to get this solution, you have to put it on a circle, which reintroduces the closed timeline curves. Yeah.